Well, good day and welcome to another episode here of the Disaster Podcast. I'm your host, Jamie Davis, the pod medic, and we've got another of our COVID-19 updates with Dr. Joe Holly. We're trying to get these out about weekly. They aren't going to be maybe every week. If there's nothing to talk about, we won't come with one, but Joe's got a few things he'd like to update us on this week, and we'll get into that in just a second. But Sam was able to join us this week, so Sam, it's good to have you back on the update.
Thank you, Jamie. Always good stuff from Dr. Joe. Can't wait to see what he's got for us.
So, Joe, why don't you jump in and give us your update?
Well, sounds fine. So, as usual, it's a bit all over the place. Hello, everybody. Hope everybody's staying healthy and doing well. So some of the stuff that's come up in the last week or so has been related to cardiac arrest, and I'll just throw a couple of quick items out there on cardiac arrest and acute cardiac disease. It is pretty clear now that the presentation of STEMI in COVID is likely to be a significant number of folks' primary presentation of COVID, meaning they won't have any other symptomatology except a STEMI. And the reason I bring that up is that there's been some concerns from the American College of Cardiology and others about how to approach those patients, and that I think we've had a bit of a false sense of security that, you know, they haven't been sick or coughing or fever, blah, blah, blah. Gosh, they've got a STEMI. They're probably fine. The point now is that pretty much anybody with a STEMI probably ought to be considered COVID positive first until they're ruled out. So you need to take precautions on all of those patients as you approach them.
Joe, can I just throw a question in here? Because I know you mentioned before that some of these people that are presenting as STEMIs aren't actually STEMIs, in that they have, you know, they take them through testing and they have clean arteries. So is that still the case?
Yes.
How we call it, what defines it as a STEMI? Or are you just talking about the symptomology that we would assume is a STEMI?
So that's a great question, Sam, and I should have clarified that. So I'm referring tonight to specifically sort of the classic STEMI, which is an occlusive vascular disease causing myocardial necrosis from a blood vessel being occluded, as opposed to some of the other cardiac diseases that we talked about before, a myocarditis, and congestive heart failure and some weird arrhythmias and all that sort of stuff. But it does appear that most of the effects of the COVID virus on the cardiac system, as I'm sure we're going to learn with many others, are all inflammatorily, if that's a word, mediated through the inflammatory system. So much like we've learned with atherosclerotic disease in general, kidney disease and others, that those are chronic inflammatory conditions that are resulting in that disease process. And COVID certainly seems to be ramping that system up so that those patients get hypercoagulable and rupture plaques and do all kinds of stuff very early and very quickly, related to sort of what we would normally expect with acute cardiovascular disease like that. So it's basically just a warning for everybody to be aware. The chest pain patient with a STEMI, a significant portion of them will be completely asymptomatic COVID positive. So please respond appropriately there. The other thing I think we're seeing is an awful lot of patients who are in cardiac arrest or that we respond to that are basically dead on the scene, and a realization that we have been very lax in testing those patients. That's part of the reason we see the numbers in New York City jump by a few thousand every so often, because they've gone back and recategorized a bunch of DOAs and that kind of stuff as probably COVID positive, and some of them they're testing. So the point here is a best practice would be to consider all of your non-resuscitated cardiac arrest patients probably should be tested postmortem to look for the COVID virus, just to make sure we're staying on top of that. Speaking of testing, there's a lot more stuff going on in the testing world. There was a relatively new test that came out very recently that is an antigen test that is being marketed pretty aggressively, shockingly. What I wanted to do there was basically just let folks know that much like these antibody tests that came out a few weeks ago, many of them are kind of shaky, and that in reality, they may have a 7 to 10% false negative rate. So if you think about that, that means that 1 out of 10 people that you test is actually positive but got a negative test back. It's interesting to note that the test that the White House uses, based on its current quote unquote outbreak there, does indeed have a 7% false negative rate. Testing every day will help, but I won't be at all surprised to know that the folks in the White House that have tested positive have been tested several times before and were always negative, and and then they turn positive. So it's still pretty early in the testing scenario. The FDA is beginning to really tighten up on this stuff finally, and I think that's going to be a very good thing. There's also some pretty good comparative studies that are being done now, and hopefully some information will begin flowing out about that within the next week or so. So I think we'll have a much better grip on the directions we need to go for, what test seems to be performing better than others, and that hopefully the craziness in that market will begin to settle down a little bit. The other thing that I think that's been quite interesting is that it's becoming more and more clear that the asymptomatic spreaders of this disease are probably the primary source of the impacts of the pandemic at this point, meaning they're probably likely for a majority of the spread. Part of what we're learning is that the viral loads in those patients are significantly higher than people thought. It is highest in nasopharyngeal secretions and tracheal secretions. That's the highest concentration of the virus. So interestingly enough, folks have a very significant viral load early on, and then it actually drops off a little bit as they begin to become symptomatic. So that leads to lots of challenges, sort of back to masks and social distancing and all the stuff that we've been trying to do. There also was some really interesting information out, and I think this is important for all the EMS and healthcare workers out there, that while masks other than N95 and above may be valuable for the general public and a casual interaction with low probability or minimally symptomatic patients, it certainly appears that they are not adequate for healthcare providers taking care of patients. You need an N95 or above if you are in the healthcare environment taking care of patients. The lesser masks, while they may filter okay, they don't seat securely enough on the face, and you inhale an awful lot of viral particles, again, usually from asymptomatic patients. What is also interesting as you look at the statistics is that healthcare workers appear to be sort of disproportionately represented amongst COVID positive, and particularly amongst COVID positive with significant illness, as well as the elderly with underlying medical conditions. So the idea here is that Those that have significant medical illnesses have an immune system that is weakened, and therefore they are at higher risk for severe illness from this disease. That is probably not the scenario in a lot of healthcare workers, but actually, as opposed to a weakened immune system, it's probably related in healthcare workers to a significantly higher viral load and exposure for those folks. So they get a lot more virus at work, and therefore the dosing for them is much higher and has the chance of making them much sicker. So anyway, lots of things to be careful of. The experts in general are basically pretty much still saying that we should expect a pretty significant rebound of this virus in the fall, especially as we reopen and exposure rates go up, and that we are likely to see, if it follows past pandemic influenza, MERS and SARS and that kind of stuff, there was an initial bump and then a quiescent period and then a much larger bump that came a few months later. So for us, that'll be in the fall when flu's coming around and all that kind of stuff. So stay tuned. This is the second inning of a probably overtime baseball game. So everybody hang in and be safe.
Hey, Joe, we got a question on the Facebook group I posted that you were going to be on tonight. And this is interesting following your discussion on masks and what should be appropriate. Rob Krause in the group asks, Dr. Joe, what's the best way to wash a mask you have to reuse? Should bleach be used or just hot soapy water? And I'm not sure you even know the answer to this because I'm sure it's not been studied, if at all. This just goes to point out we don't have enough masks to go around.
Well, you're right, Jamie. Hi, Rob, and thanks for your question. Cleaning of the mask remains to be a little bit undecided. I think bleach is probably unnecessary. Most folks, for sort of typical home use, you can spray these masks with a topical disinfectant type spray and then put them in, put them at about 170 degrees for about 30 minutes. And that seems to be fine. So what folks are doing is basically kind of putting them on a cookie sheet, putting a little bit of water on the cookie sheet, putting them in a low oven and letting them cook for about 30 minutes. And that seems to be pretty effective in killing off the virus, et cetera. You don't want to microwave them because they have metal clips and stuff in them. And obviously that'll be some issues for the microwave. And topical agents on them for cleaning, apart from a little bit of gentle soap and water, tend to deteriorate the mask over time. And obviously they can only be reused a certain number of times before you just simply can't clean them anymore.
That's great, Joe. And thanks a lot for that. I'm sure a lot of other people probably had a similar question. So that's very helpful to do that in the oven. Just make sure you remember it's in there before your wife fires it up for dinner.
Yep.
You're going to smell cooked N95 mask pretty quick at 350.
Not for dinner, thank you. Joe, I had a question on antibodies. Apparently, people are thinking that if they've gotten through COVID and they have antibodies, that they're now immune to being infected again. And the sense I get is that's not exactly true, or there hasn't been enough study on it to tell.
Well, I think it's a little bit of all those things. So we need to be very careful about our terminology here. So a positive COVID test after you have, quote unquote, recovered depends on the test. If you're doing a PCR test, the sort of diagnostic test that looks for viral messenger RNA, those tests can be positive for a significant period of time, weeks in many cases. And what those tests are probably detecting at that time is fragments of the RNA of the virus that the body continues to shred after it has destroyed the virus. So those viral particles, those RNA particles, will still be present in the tissues, although it's not a complete virus and it's not harmful. It's just genetic debris, basically. If we're talking about sort of the serology antibody test, then you are correct that the data is a little inconclusive right now. It does appear that folks generally will develop some sort of antibody reaction, usually with IgM, and that antibody confers some sort of protection to the patient. How long that lasts is a bit unknown, and whether or not the amount of protection you have varies with the severity of the illness is also not very clearly known. The thought is that a minimally symptomatic person had a relatively low viral load and therefore had a relatively mild inflammatory response to that and therefore didn't make very many antibodies and therefore may not have as much protection against a re-exposure to the virus as someone who was quite sick and was ill for a long time and had a pronounced inflammatory response to the virus and made lots of antibodies. We don't know that for certain. It's sort of how it works in general with these kind of things, but COVID definitely has tested our prior knowledge and proven to be somewhat quirky in the way it does things compared to other viruses that we've seen.
And as you said earlier, Joe, it's the evidence is showing potentially that the asymptomatic carriers may have a significantly higher viral load than suspected before.
I think that's exactly right. That's the real challenge with getting a pandemic under control is because, you can't tell who you need to avoid. That's the plus of getting much additional testing out there is that we can begin to test lots of people, hopefully identifying these asymptomatic folks prior to them going out and exposing other people. It's certainly a strong case for the need for additional testing and the need for sort of maintaining the social distancing aspects as best you can, especially as we begin to reopen and get back to business.
Well, Joe, thanks so much for coming on and sharing the update this week. I know Sam and I appreciate that greatly. A big shout out to Paragon Medical Education Group for the support that you and your team bring to help us get the Disaster Podcast and all this great information out there. We really appreciate it.
Thanks, guys. My pleasure as always, and I look forward to talking to you later this week.
Yes, we will. Thank you, Joe.